KPFA studios in Berkeley, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I'm Khalil Bendib. Mali Hay is under the weather this week.
The state is not going to be able to win, and society and social groups, protesters and so on, are not likely to overturn the regime as fast as happened in Egypt.
This hour will bring you a recent lecture by George Mason University political scientist Bassam Haddad, titled The Syrian Uprising and the Limits of Regime Resilience. The Syrian Revolution is approaching its first anniversary, and the situation there is looking bloodier by the day. In their latest push to crush the opposition for the past 3 weeks, Syrian troops have been shelling Homs heavily, and in particular the Baba Amr neighborhood, with tanks, artillery shells, and rockets. To get a better understanding of the situation in Syria, we bring you a talk by George Mason University political scientist Professor Bassam Haddad. He spoke at UC Berkeley earlier this month about the Syrian uprising and the regime's limitations in suppressing the year-old uprising.
I will shift gears now and move to the much more interesting and depressing topic, which is the Syrian uprising today, by presenting a narrative or many narratives that depart from the dominant narratives we hear in the media, American, European, or Arab. And I'll probably say something about how reporting actually has exacerbated the fog that is the Syrian situation. I'll try to answer four questions. I'll ask four questions. I'll try to answer them. And hopefully we can have a discussion about these questions or parameters. The first question is, what explains the Syrian uprising? What is key there? And I discussed some of it. The second is, what explains the resilience of the regime? Why is it that after a year, the regime continues to exist and is not showing signs of disappearing? It's not necessarily showing signs of more power, but it's certainly not showing signs of disappearance. And then third, why is there a stalemate today? Why do we look at this year's situation and cannot just make out clearly with confidence what is likely to happen next? And finally, where is the uprising going? The first question, which is what explains the Syrian uprising. One way to look at this phenomenon, aside from looking at the three or four arguments that keep popping up in the literature, not just in more establishment literature or magazines connected to think tanks or to government or to right-wing establishments, but even in what we can call centrist literature, and even in center-left literature, there's an overemphasis on questions of sectarianism. There's overemphasis on questions of authoritarianism, as if that should explain uprisings, at the same time that, you know, authoritarian rule has existed for 40 or 50 years without any kinds of serious mass uprising. So why now? These arguments do not actually explain why now. The sectarian question actually also in the case of Syria does not explain very much, because it's even conceived in a problematic way, whereby people say that 10% of the population is Alawi and Alawis are in power and they're fighting everyone else, and this is necessarily a fascist, brutal, sectarian regime. This is not the case. In the Syrian case, as we will discuss in just a little bit, Syria is a country of minorities. And if you consider, even demographically, if you want to sort of, for argument's sake, take that argument further, the Alawis, which constitute 10 to 11% of the Syrian population, the Christians 9 to 10%, give or take marginal error of 2 to 3% actually. But we have 11% of Alawis, 10% Christians. We have Ismailis, Druze. We have, besides Ismailis, Druze, and Shi'is. And then besides sects, we have Kurds who are Sunni, but they're not Arab. We have, of course, Armenians and Turkmens and so on. So if you consider the entire demographic map, you come up with a much more complex map that's not 10 versus 90, but it's more like 45% of minorities that usually are more sympathetic to the regime. Even if they don't like the regime, they're more sympathetic to the status quo, because under this status quo, they've had better chances than what they've had before, or anticipate that it will never be as good as it is today. And then you have, if you count the Kurds, you have even a smaller percentage that is the majoritarian Sunni population. But then if you also consider that partners of the regime at the top levels, especially in the business community, are Sunni, you will actually be faced with a 50-50 situation. I don't subscribe to this approach at all. I'm just trying to say that if you want to count the beans, let's count the beans. And when you count the beans, based on the rationale of that sectarian argument, it doesn't actually measure up. And that, in fact, does explain, as I will share in a minute, the resilience of the regime. And why is it that, you know, people say, how could 10% be still in power? Well, it's not just 10%, and it's not that simple. So, bottom line, what explains the Syrian uprising is, in my view, something that, let me say, without the following, we're not going to be able to explain the uprising. And the following is simply that we've had what we can call a dual polarization in Syria as a result of 20 to 30 years of a particular pattern of development within the context of authoritarian rule, which always actually pushes people to express discontent in some way. But we have a dual polarization, first between rich and poor, vertical polarization across the country, where in the past 20 to 30 years, the number of unemployed, the ability of one individual in Syria working at a decent job to make it using just this one job, where more and more people have been disenfranchised by the year, especially between 2000 and 2010. What we have as a result is a very polarized class structure that has affected every single family, even the lower middle class families in the entire country. That polarization, vertical polarization, is mixed in some way with regional polarization. The pattern of development that has been adopted by the state and its partners has completely, after 1986, abandoned the countryside and abandoned this conception of the welfare state gradually, and left the countryside and the metropolitan cities that are not the largest, including places like Homs, Hama, Ladiye, Tartus, and other places, and even in northeast Syria, left them either impoverished or underdeveloped, and focused most of the development on the two major cities that, coincidentally, are now the ones that seem to be holding up, at least in relative terms. So this dual polarization is one where it overlaps in the countryside, because the entire country, the entire social demographic of Syria has been affected by this polarization in terms of rich and poor. And then the country, people in the countryside have also been affected by this regional polarization. So it is no wonder that the emergence of these uprisings and the most intense center of the uprising is either in the countryside or in the smaller cities around Syria that suffered the most, especially if you consider the drought that Syria has undergone between 2003 to 2010, which produced at least 1.2 to 1.5 million migrants from the countryside to the city. Migrants that were not absorbed by the cities, by most cities, except for Aleppo and Damascus, which had sufficient infrastructure and a sufficient standard of living in terms of family members and extended family to be able to absorb these migrants. But all of the other areas in Syria, the smaller cities, actually became more and more impoverished as a result of this natural situation, which is not all that natural considering that the state neglected the development of these areas in various ways, from irrigation system deficiencies and inadequacies to other kinds of neglect. So without understanding this dual polarization, it's very difficult to recognize why the Syrian uprising is actually a rural uprising more than anything else. The people in the cities were not ready to take to the streets and risk their lives in front of bullets at this point, and this is why there is in Syria this kind of bifurcation, and you wonder if these people live in the same country. Well, they kind of don't. They kind of don't, as a result of what I just shared with you. However, the spark that produced the uprising, which would have happened anyway down the line, a few years down the line, but the spark was the domino effect of Tunisia and Egypt and so on. And, of course, the incident that started the uprising, which is some kids in Daraa in South Syria writing on the wall that, yes, Shab Yunid Sat al-Nizam, about 10 to 15 kids were rounded up. They were tortured. Tortured in ways that are really horrible. And in response to this torture, a year ago or a year and a half ago, nothing would have happened. But after the Tunisian and Egyptian uprisings, in response to this torture, people went to the streets. They were emboldened. And in response to this going to the streets, the regime clamped down, as it would clamp down usually in the past 40 years, by basically killing people. That created this kind of cycle and fed into the hands of basically anybody who wants to protest in Syria, especially in areas where people had very little to lose. Hence, the beginning few months, as you can probably tell, even Homs, the beginning few weeks, even Homs was actually spared. We were talking about the countryside. And then slowly it began to develop into the smaller cities. So that's the number one. Number two, what explains the resilience of the regime? In short, if we look at the Syrian regime and we compare it with the Egyptian and Tunisian regimes, we find that the Syrian regime at the top, in terms of the party, bureaucracy, army, security services, Republican Guard, and the top echelons of the leadership, these parts, first of all, are organic. They're extremely cohesive and coherent. They're not cohesive and coherent because there are different institutions that agree on principles. They're cohesive, coherent, and organic because none of them has autonomy. So the generals and the army do not have the kind of autonomy that the SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces in Egypt, has. So they do not actually come and talk with the regime leadership about what to do, and they agree simply because the regime leadership is more powerful. The autonomy that exists in Egypt, and I would argue, relatively speaking, in Tunisia, does not exist in the Syrian army leadership, especially after the 1980s. In fact, some people can go even... I actually do go a little further to say that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when Hafez Assad came to power as a result of the collective movement and sidelined the more sort of ideological branch of the Ba'ath Party, the first thing that Assad did is empty out the party and the military from their basically political content and authority, and shift this authority to the security services that can be managed in a much easier way. And after the 1973 war, this transformation was complete because the regime realized that it no longer will fight a war, outside war, in any serious way. So it neglected the army, neglected everything that had to do with any kind of like serious quote-unquote resistance or attempt to actually restore the Golan Heights, and focused on the security services, where the locus of authority is in Syria. Security services, the Republican Guard run by Bashar's brother, Maher, and of course the top leadership, which is a couple of individuals. All in all, it's not just one or two individuals. It's much more than that. But we're talking about the stripping of the party and the bureaucracy and the army from any serious autonomy. That cohesion at the top is not matched by any other Arab country except for maybe Iraq. But even in Iraq, the kind of explicit sectarianism that existed also prevented that cohesion or that autonomy from being a source of power when the regime is in crisis. And Libya, except that, again, in Libya, the total collapse of institutions other than Muammar and his Green Book also did not make this coherence or organic nature of the top levels of the local elite powerful at all. Actually, they just dissipated, and Gaddafi had to pay people to fight the protesters, whereas in Syria, that will not happen. There are enough people in Syria not connected to the regime who will actually come to the regime's defense. Why and why not? I don't know. We can discuss this, but it's a totally different situation. So we have coherence at the top and cohesion at the top, which prevents any kind of solution similar to Tunisia or Egypt, whereby somebody will come and tell Bashar, can you please leave so that we can restore the regime or solve this crisis in this manner, similar to Egypt and Tunisia. It's not possible. The regime and Bashar are one. not because there are an agreement, but because there isn't a party or an actor or an institution that has enough autonomy to come and make a suggestion of the sort. People, every time I say this, and people tell me, so, you know, he's basically overpowered the others. It's not that he overpowered the others. It's that this is how the regime is constituted. The absence of autonomy of other institutions make this organic situation almost the status quo. It's not based on agreement on principles among autonomous institutions. That coherence creates a zero-sum relationship between state or regime and protesters. Zero-sum meaning every single unit of gain on part of the protesters happens at the expense of the regime, at least from the regime's perspective, and vice versa. This is why the regime from the very beginning has never even contemplated saying Fahmtkum, like what's his name said, Zain al-Abidin, never contemplated even suggesting that I will resign after this or I will do anything that is meaningful by way of concessions. The only thing that they conceded is the emergency law, as if the concept of law in Syria actually is consequential. And it's not. It's only consequential when the powers that be decide to make it consequential. So it is consequential, but it's arbitrarily consequential based on the exegetical mindset of the regime. So on the other side, if you look at the regime as an organic or cohesive actor, on the other side, society is actually quite heterogeneous. As opposed to Egypt and Tunisia, Syrian society is quite heterogeneous, as I discussed with you. This heterogeneity ultimately, to make a long story short, reduces dramatically the potential for collective action. And it happens in a state where for 30 or 40 years, the individuals became atomized. Atomized in the sense that we have not actually witnessed the kind of collaboration within society to produce institutions, associations, or anything of the sort outside the realm of the regime. I'm talking about political institutions and associations of any sort. So individuals in the Syrian case have a lot less practice in doing that, have a lot less connections with others. Even in building civil society institutions that are not extremely political at all, there's a lot less basically experience in that regard. And there are all these different groups that have been in many ways manipulated by the state to believe, and these people believe, that the regime is the best thing they will ever have. If you go to Syria, for instance, during Easter, and you see how the regime actually deploys its army and security services around the Christian areas in Damascus and Aleppo and Hama and Homs, you think that Jesus is coming. For real. And the Christian community in Syria, just like the Christian community in Iraq, by the way, in many ways feels that this is going to be the best deal they will have ever compared to a majoritarian rule. This could be a function of problematic perception or not, but it's not without some truth in the sense that the regime has gone out of its way to protect minorities in order because of its own rational self-interest. So we have cohesion at the top, heterogeneity within society, and the outcome is basically at the structural level. We haven't even talked about all the other things that actually favor the regime in many ways in the short run, including power and external relations and so on. Structurally, internally speaking, this resilience is can be understood as a function of this very basic relationship. People might say, well, you have a similar situation in Libya because you have tribes in society and the regime is coherent. But in Libya, Mr. Gaddafi, because he's, you know, the brilliant strategist that he is, destroyed all institutions that connected individuals to institutions to the state. In Syria, they've actually done quite a bit of work to make these connections, not as much as Egypt, but sufficiently so that the regime actually has allies that have a stake in maintaining the status quo, and has allies even among those who do not have a direct stake. In other words, people who are not privileged, but the regime has you know, developed a particular kind of regional and international policy that boosted its what can be called nationalist credentials in ways that people in Syria bought into and regionally bought into, whereas Gaddafi has, for instance, not done any of that. Third, why is there a stalemate? It's a very simple consequence of this analysis, that there would be a stalemate. The state is not going to be able to win, and society, social groups, protesters, and so on, are not likely to overturn the regime as fast as happened in Egypt. So the stalemate, in short, again, is really a function of two movements that, or two things that are taking place today. It's caused first by the growing power of the internal opposition. I'm not going to talk about the external opposition. The external opposition is in many ways a disaster by the admission of the external opposition members who say this in private, not in public. But I'm talking about the internal opposition, which is where the real power of the opposition lies, whereby there is something to say about the internal opposition's power that is actually quite impressive, despite the fact that as time goes by, parts of the internal opposition are moving in directions that are problematic for the opposition in general, and that parts of the opposition are receiving lots of support from problematic parties and so on. Still, the core of the internal opposition has not actually gone that route. So we cannot simply use this excuse that some are, you know, part of some sort of conspiracy to condemn the entire opposition. So the internal opposition is gaining in power as a result of its increasing militarization and coordination. The internal opposition was peaceful the first few weeks. After the first few months, it became more or less peaceful. And then, of course, in the summer, it became militarized. And then in the fall, it actually developed as a result of simple neighborhood networks that developed to actually first defend themselves, protect their families. And now they're actually on the offensive as a result of the continuing growth of what is called the Free Syrian Army, which doesn't really exist as an institution with a central command and control. It exists simply as, it's kind of like Al-Qaeda after 2001. No, I don't mean to compare, but I mean to compare structurally speaking, that if you are a deserter from the army or a defector, usually always at the low level, you're automatically part of the Free Syrian Army, but you don't know who the other Free Syrian Army people are. Or you claim you are, right? So the point is that as a result of this, the opposition in time is growing in numbers, and the more people that are killed by the regime, this campaign of destruction in Homs today, in Bab Amro and Munshaat and so on, is producing more and more fighters who are learning to use a rifle that they couldn't use eight or 10 months ago, who are coordinating with other neighborhoods where there are similar groups who earlier did not have the means to coordinate with, and so on. So the opposition's power is actually growing by the day, at the same time that the regime's power is not growing. In fact, it is actually collapsing if you divide the notion of power into different dimensions. Power is not just the ability to kill and control and oppress. Power is also the ability to mobilize and to incentivize, and the regime has lost that part of its power. We can call it authority. It's lost its authority. It cannot make a decision that people in areas where the regime does not have tanks, that people will carry out. So the regime has lost its authority, maintained its physical and material and military power, which means that as time goes by, the morale of people working with the regime, fighting with the regime, has been actually decreasing. Deserters are increasing. The number of, or the percentage of Syrian territory that is no longer occupied by the regime or controlled by the regime is increasing by the week. And this is out of a strategic decision by the regime, simply because it does not have enough loyal troops to control all places at the same time. Because as you go down in the ranks in the Syrian army, which is about 250 to 300,000 people, as you go down in the ranks, you'll find people who are less inclined to shoot at people or to fight other Syrians. So the regime doesn't rely on this bunch unless it's something like circling somewhere and doing nothing or just staying put. It relies on the more loyal divisions within the army, which are the top divisions, or within the security services, or within the Republican Guard. And these are common finite numbers. That's why you see the situation in Syria with the state and opposition dynamic. They hit one place, they focus on it, and then they move to another place. And that's as a result of a strategic decision. And some places are completely left to just fester, because nothing's going to happen there anyway. It's not a strategic place, so they just leave it alone. And so this is what's causing the stalemate, in the sense that we do not have a clear path whereby the regime is completely overtaking the opposition, and we certainly don't have a situation where the opposition is overtaking the regime, because the opposition's weaponry is limited to guns, some mortar rockets, very small, and nothing that can really launch an offensive, even though they started launching an offensive. The other issue here is that the number of people dying is increasing, but the distribution of the people dying is also changing. In August, most of the people who were dying, or August and before, are people on the streets that are protesting, usually chanting and so on. Now, most people who are dying are fighters on both sides. First of all, you have more Syrian fighters who belong to the Syrian military and Syrian authorities are dying because the other guys are now killing them. They have the wherewithal to actually do that. And people on the side of the protesters who are dying are mostly fighters. That's why when you go to YouTube today and you check YouTube, you know, all the YouTube videos, and then Google, you know, YouTube and say, put May, you see totally different scenes. In May, you see people chanting in big demonstrations, and then all of a sudden somebody's shooting at them, and then they dissipate, and we hear the second day that 20 people died. Today, you don't see these kinds of things as much. What you see is the final result of people dying as a result of bombing, like in Homs, or things of the sort. You hardly see that these original kinds of causes of death, which means that the uprising and the state's response basically has been transformed into something that's more military-like. Finally, where is the uprising going? Well, to make a long story short, and those who have, you know, read anything that I've written recently will know that I have making this argument, and that is that the Syrian uprising has been transformed or is undergoing a transformation from a legitimate fight, a legitimate domestic fight against a dictatorship, to something that is more regional and more international, which has become an occasion for various groups, institutions, states, and so on, to attempt to restructure power relations in the region. So there is a shift from, at least in terms of the larger picture, from this being an internal fight, people against their government, against their dictatorship, in fact, to something that is much more complex, much more global, much more regional, much more global, that involves attempts to redraw the map of the region. And this is why many of us are of two minds about what to do about Syria, because we oppose the regime, and if you're like me, you've opposed the regime even before the uprising for decades, speaking against the oppressive nature of the Syrian regime. But right now, as a result of this transformation, the costs are not just to the Syrian people, there are likely to be costs to the region itself, given some of these attempts to actually take out Syria, isolate Iran, weaken Hezbollah, and reestablish a kind of dictatorship, in a way, if you will, over the region as a whole by the powers that be, including Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the United States, Israel, and that camp. So it's become more complex, and it's a situation where people find themselves having to come down somewhere in terms of what you prioritize. And if you prioritize fighting the regime completely, if you prioritize that, then you're asked for military intervention from anybody, from whether it's the United States or NATO or conservative Arab regimes or even Israel. And some people are calling for that internally. Actually, most of the internal opposition has dropped the two no's out of the three no's, which is no to sectarianism. They haven't dropped that officially, although you see more sectarianism, but they've dropped no to violence and no to international intervention. They've dropped them in the summer, like early summer. And those who are outside, who only prioritize fighting imperialism, are actually also completely neglecting the plight of Syrians under the regime. And I think both positions are problematic, and I think there is a way to oppose both the regime and oppose military intervention, which also sounds cold because you're basically saying that the regime kill more and more people so long as there's no international military intervention, which is not an easy position to take. But there are options, there are third ways that involve some of these autonomous groups internally who are fighting. And with time, as I said, time is not on the side of the regime. However, it's not easy to make that calculation. It's not easy to just say no to international intervention no matter what happens in Syria. But people are falling on either side, and that's why it's a very poisonous topic, the question of Syria.
Bassam Haddad is the author of Business Networks in Syria, The Political Economy of Authoritarian Resilience. He spoke on the Syrian uprising early this month at UC Berkeley. To learn more, visit vomena.org or jadalya.com. From KPFA, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.